Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI, listener-funded radio. We're a socialist radio show and podcast from the members of the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Today, first, we'll be covering the headlines from a socialist analysis, and then we'll be going into the debacle that is the Hudson Yards development, speaking with some of the workers who have been fighting the developer, Stephen Ross. In studio, we have Laura Gabby, a carpenter from New York City DSA's labor branch. We'll also be speaking with Levi Mezzanetti from the Carpenters Local 157 about the billions that Stephen Ross and his company Related have already extracted from the city and how they're fighting now against paying the prevailing wage. As always, the last quarter of the show is dedicated to you, the audience, to hear your perspective on the fight for socialism in New York City. Now let's go to the headlines.
Brooklyn District Attorney Eric Gonzalez has dropped the sexual assault charges against the two NYPD officers who admitted to having sex with then 18-year-old Anna Chambers while she was in their custody in 2017. Forcing someone to have sex with you is commonly known as rape, but I guess it's too much to ask law enforcement to have a basic sense of human decency. While a law clarifying that people under arrest or otherwise in custody cannot consent to sex with police officers has been passed since, it's clear that this is just another case of New York's paramilitary department having a get-out-of-jail-free card while thousands of New Yorkers are locked behind bars simply for being too poor to live in America. Zero accountability for police violence is not isolated to New York. One-third of all Americans killed by strangers are killed by the police. Multiple studies have found that at least 40% of police officer families experience domestic violence, a rate that is 2 to 4 times higher than the general population. In Sacramento, the district attorney announced that the two cops who murdered Stephon Clark in his grandparents' backyard last year would not be charged with any crimes. However, organizers are fighting back against the vicious brutality of the American police state. The people of Sacramento hit the streets and packed the city council meeting in defiance of the white supremacist state's official sanction of another extrajudicial killing of an unarmed black person. After years of pressure from activists, J.P. Morgan Chase announced that they will stop financing CEO Group and CoreCivic, the largest operators of private prisons and immigrant detention centers in the United States. In labor news, women workers continue to lead the fight against neoliberal austerity. The New York State Nurses Association has voted to authorize a strike at 3 of the city's major hospital systems if their concerns about staffing shortages and overcrowding are not addressed. Rank-and-file teachers continue to lead the nationwide fight for public education. Several Kentucky school districts were closed this past Thursday after teachers called out sick to voice their opposition to a bill that will benefit private schools at the expense of public schools. Teachers in Texas and Indiana packed their state houses to push for higher wages and increased funding for students. All around the globe, socialist feminists demonstrated against capitalism and patriarchy on International Women's Day. In Puerto Rico, feminist organizations shut down the banks in the island's largest shopping mall in protest against debt, colonialism, and austerity. While an estimated 190,000 marched during the women's strike in Santiago, Chile. Solidarity with women everywhere organizing to build a better world.
And we're back from whoever that weirdo was reading off the headlines. So before we dive into the situation specifically at Hudson Yards, I just want to introduce our two guests, Laura and Levi, and ask them who they are and how they got involved in labor organizing. So, Laura, if you just want to start off with a little description about yourself.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Laura Gabby, and I've been a carpenter for 7 years now. And I was elected trustee of Local 157 this past summer, along with Levi Messinetti here, who was elected president of 157. I guess I'll say my work is typically I work both outdoors and indoors. I've worked on high-rise concrete jobs. Right now, I'm doing indoor work, putting up acoustical ceilings. I've done woodworking. So the work that we do is kind of a mix of all different types of work, all different types of carpentry.
The work you're describing sounds a lot harder and more labor intensive than a lot of high paid office workers and in real estate developers. But Levi, can you describe who you are and what kind of work you're involved in?
Yeah, thanks. I'm a rank and file carpenter number one, and I've been a carpenter in the Carpenters Union since 1995. And like Laura, I do a wide range of carpentry work, anything from concrete forms, heavy construction, interior, commercial work, residential work. We do it all. We build it. You know, people like us built this whole city. And I also have a second job. I'm the president of Local 157, and that's a recent thing. I was elected maybe about half a year ago. And so I spend a lot of time doing carpentry and doing the work of the Carpenters Union. So we represent about 8,600 members, and we are the largest local in the International Union, which is United States and Canada.
What kind of work goes into being the president of a local? And how does that tie in with what you have to do every day in the workplace?
After work, as a carpenter, 3-4 days a week, I go to the office and there's decisions that have to be made. There's things you have to sign. A guy retires, you sign his paperwork. A guy enters the union, you sign their paperwork. We have members that get sick donations, and you have to go over all of that kind of stuff. And you chair the meetings. When you're the president of the local, you have to chair the executive board meeting and the general meeting, and create committees, and just oversee the general operations of the union. You know, all the bills are getting paid, and all the plans are being made for all the functions that we have in the upcoming year. You have to really kind of see around the corner sometimes to think about what's coming up next week, next month, next year. So there's just a lot of planning going on when it comes to that. And that's basically what it is to be the president of the local.
Like making sure that the workers have a voice and representation, and that you're looking out for your other workers' interests on the day-to-day.
That's true, too. And as delegates, which Laura and I are both delegates also, we represent our local in the meeting with the other delegates from all of the other locals that make up our district council, which is about 25,000 members and their families. So that's where we basically represent them in the delegate meeting. We're representatives, and that's part of the job too. Yeah.
DSA, democracy in the workplace is such a critical thing of the world that we're trying to build. And Laura, you are also a member of the DSA. So what led you to join DSA and this type of organizing within DSA specifically?
So I joined DSA like a lot of people after Trump got elected. I knew about DSA for a little while. I saw DSA getting involved in good work around the Bernie campaign. I was very inspired by that campaign. I was already involved in my union. I got involved in my union from day one in the Carpenters. So that was labor organizing work was already work that I was doing and involved in. But especially after Trump got elected, I I saw the need to branch out and to do broader work and connect my labor organizing work to a broader movement, because it became abundantly clear after Trump got elected that that sort of staying in our own little bubbles was not a possibility anymore if we wanted to actually win. So I joined DSA and became connected with a lot of other labor activists and got more heavily involved in DSA's labor work.
So would you say the main project that you're working on within DSA is bringing together what maybe is siloed aspects of the labor movement to work together to fight for their collective interests?
Yeah, I would say I would say that's part of it. I think that's one of the strengths of the labor branch in DSA is that it's it brings together union members and sometimes staff from a lot of different unions and parts of the labor movement that aren't necessarily always in touch with each other, especially among the rank and file. And also, one of my main goals is to get more DSA members involved in the labor movement because, unfortunately, with union density rolling back over the years, it's there's fewer people out there now that have a strong connection to the labor movement right now. So I see that as a big part of the work of getting. Getting other younger people, I'm in my 30s, but other younger people like me involved in the labor movement and more heavily connect, doing either labor solidarity work or joining unions themselves. So.
You just mentioned the decline of union density, mm-hmm. that there are less people now than 40 years ago involved in unions and organized in the workplace. And a huge part of that is billionaires like Stephen Ross fighting against working people. And Stephen Ross, if people are not aware, and his company Related are behind Hudson Yards. So can you guys explain what the Hudson Yards is and how has the city and state government provided resources to this real estate developer at the expense of working class New Yorkers?
I can speak on that. Hudson Yards is like a mixed-use development. It's one of the largest developments ever in the United States in the private sector. And you're going to have commercial. You're going to have residential. People are going to live there. You're going to have retail, a lot of retail. There's going to be parks in there. There's supposed to be some affordable housing in there. We'll see how that goes. Usually they find a way to skirt their responsibility when it comes to affordable housing. But the thing about Ross and the fact that he's a billionaire who's looking to capitalize on taxpayer input is that it's typical. Not him, but his company has benefited from about $6 billion worth of taxpayer money that's gone into infrastructure, including an extended subway line. A 7 train goes all the way to 11th Avenue now, which was a tremendous expense to the taxpayers. Now, the Parks Department, they're putting in tons of parks over there. There's a lot of road work that has to be done. Infrastructure is not all of it. It's also tax incentives and tax breaks that they're getting, and it adds up to actually about double what they were proposing to give to Amazon. And a lot of people don't realize that, but it's a huge burden on the taxpayers. And I'm against it. I don't think that anybody should be able to not pay their taxes, whether you're an individual or whether you're a corporation, a real estate, whether you view it as an investment or not. Everything is an investment. We already invested $6 billion into this project, And there's no reason why a billionaire shouldn't pay his taxes on that. And, you know, I feel strongly about that. And a lot of other people feel strongly about that. And I think it should be highlighted. And people who say that that money is not real are putting a spin on it that really isn't true. That money may not be real, but that's because you didn't pay it. If you pay your taxes, that money's real. And that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, it seems especially absurd. You know, they're benefiting from this extension of the subway line when in so many other areas in the city, people really need access to a good subway. And it seems like the subway is collapsing in so many places. So to put all these resources into that and then act like they're not getting any benefits from the state, from the city, seems ridiculous. It's pretty clear that they've taken advantage of this public investment and now are trying to undercut workers' wages and undermine unions. It just feels like it's very egregious, selfish act yet again by a billionaire real estate developer. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener sponsor WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. Today we're talking about the Hudson Yards development and the buildings trades battle there. So we're about to go to a segment from the picket lines that were happening last week. But before we do, I just wanted to ask you guys, when did the picket start and like why specifically did they start?
So the very first rally outside of Hudson Yards happened on October 19th, 2017 at 6 a.m. in the morning. Yes, you heard that right. Construction workers get up extremely early. They started, I would say, because a lot of people, both rank and file and leadership within the building trades, realized very quickly that this was going to be an extremely important line in the sand for the building trades. As the largest private development in U.S. history, happening in Midtown Manhattan, which traditionally has always gone, jobs have always gone union. The idea that Related and Steve Ross would be trying to build non-union or build open shop, which means, you know, a mix of some union, some non-union. It's just totally beyond what the norm would be at all, and it sets a really bad precedent for the rest of the city and the rest of the country. So it became clear that this was the big fight, this was the major line in the sand, and so you know, people organized a first rally. It was smaller at first, and then it grew from there with 6 a.m. rallies every single week. And those have happened every single week since October 19th, 2017. So going on, I think, a year and 4 months now. And at some point, also, Tuesday rallies were added at 3:30 p.m. at Columbus Circle, below Steve Ross's home. So.
Well, thank you for laying out kind of like the real terms and like the antagonisms of why this picket line emerged. So let's go live to our audio from the pickets. Maybe not live, it's pre-recorded.
Hi, this is Annalisa with Revolutions Per Minute. Last week, Thursday, at 6 a.m., I went to the corner of 34th Street and 10th Avenue. If you've ever taken a Bolt or a Megabus, you've walked past this corner. But for over a year now, every Thursday morning at 6, there's been a protest, a picket, organized by rank-and-file building trades members who are outraged at the treatment that they've gotten from the developer of Hudson Yards Related. I took a moment to catch up with a couple of the people who were there. So here's Candace and Adrian.
So Candace, if you could tell me like just a little bit about yourself, you know, how you came into the building trades and what part of the building trades you're in.
I came through a program new.
Uh-huh.
I was actually a bartender and a nanny, and a friend of mine wanted me to help her build a bar, and she was in the trades, and she's like, there's union, go for it, and I went through the new program and got in, and that was 10 years ago. So, yeah. I'm with the Carpenters, 157.
All right, my name is Adrian. I'm a local 3 electrician for 18 years. I'm working here in the Hudson Yards. Right now, there's 3 open shop buildings that are hiring non-union workers. Non-union workers that get hired by these companies are usually not women. Their diversity stinks. They're undercutting those non-union workers. And we're here in Count Me In to make sure that workers, whether they're union or not, do not get exploited. Those 3 buildings are exploiting workers right now. They're not hiring women. There's actually legal actions against sexual harassment that women have endured in those buildings when they have been hired. And on 3/15, we're going to have a massive demonstration against the corporate greed going on in the city. Also, the Hudson Yards, Steve Ross, owner of Related, has taken public funds to build Hudson Yards, and he is not paying prevailing wage on these projects. That's another thing we're going to be fighting for on 3/15. And we hope everybody comes out.
So then, I guess, in terms of this battle that's going on with Hudson Yards, can you give me a little bit of a background about like why you're here?
We have a movement right now, solidarity and with other trades. And as a carpenter, we were forced, our local signed a contract without talking to members. And they signed a contract and had us come work at this job site with the open shop. Right now, Hudson Yards is the biggest open shop we have. And to force another trade to work with a non-union company or with other non-union carpenters. Yeah, I just think leadership is selling members out at this moment and they're not listening to the members. And that's why I decided to get involved with this movement, stand ground and say, this is a union town and that's what New York is.
I come because I don't see any women going to work in these 3 projects, you know, and as a woman in the trades, I don't see a future for myself as long as non-union contractors are being hired. There's no women going to work there. Where's my future in that? And as a taxpayer, I don't believe that our money should be going to subsidize these corporations, and these corporations are not giving a living wage back to the people. That's what gets me involved.
And then specifically, I mean, you mentioned the subsidies. Can you tell me, like, about Related and Steve Ross and, you know, what your thoughts on them?
Well, the subsidies. Say, for example, the 7 train. Without the 7 train being extended to come over here to the Hudson Yards, the Hudson Yards would be nothing, absolutely nothing. Who's going to walk all the way out here to the river? I don't know why Steve Ross is calling himself a philanthropist. Meanwhile, we're the ones that are the philanthropists. We, the workers that are being undercut, you know, we're the ones funding his philanthropy.
Hell no! Will we quit?
Hell no!
Will we quit? Hell no!
Can you tell me a little bit about what's at stake, right? So what does it mean, union construction versus non-union construction?
We worked hard to get this wage to what it is, and to undercut another person that's doing our exact same job and not paying into taxes and into their health care for them and their future, it's a disgrace. They're not hurting just the employee, but they're hurting the city around them as well, because those people don't have the same money we're making in order to pay back to the city and, you know, go out and spend the money in the city. You know, they're doing the exact same work and they should be given the same fair wage as we are. And that's what I think our fight is now, is to make sure workers that are doing the same thing, we're all paid, and that means to get them more into unions. And that's what our union should be looking at, is getting those workers, you know, into us and educating them that they could make better wages and get a health care.
And specifically this developer Related, what can you tell me about them?
He's very rich. That's what I can tell you about him. He's a very rich man with lots of money, and it's unfair. He says he wants to break unions. And I just don't understand how we can even be talking to him, you know? It's like, I'm going to break you. Why are we even friends with this guy, is what my thing is. People with money can do whatever they want at this point, and that's pretty much what's going on.
So that was the sound from the picket lines last week. It was really incredible to hear what the workers have to say, and everyone should be in solidarity with workers that are organizing to build a better future. But getting back specifically to the issue at hand, what was the original deal with Related?
Well, the original deal with Related that we saw in the delegate room was the entire Hudson Yards, as it pertains to the carpenters, we were going to take 10% off the top, and that was a concession that we made. And it was agreed to, and it was going to encompass the entire Hudson Yards. Less than 2 years later, we learned that Stephen Ross changed the address from 50 Hudson Yards to 55 Hudson Yards. And now he wanted a new deal, and he wanted to go open shop, which, as Laura said, is, you know, some union and some non-union. And we never worked like that before. We're not used to that. It's to us, it's a hazardous way to work. We work much safer than non-union workers. We're trained for it. Construction work is dangerous. So, you know, we're reluctant to work like that. And it goes against everything that we stand for when it comes to solidarity.
Do you want to dive a little bit more into why a union shop is safer than a non-union shop? Like, why is being in a union – it's not just about the higher wages, which are absolutely deserved, but it's about creating a safe workplace.
Yeah, there's a lot of unions. There's a lot of reasons to build union, and we only have a short time. So I'm going to get into the safety aspect of it. We – and the unions are trained. We have a certified training courses. We take classes. We take precautions. And as a result, you can look at our record. Non-union construction in New York City averages about 15 to 16 deaths every year for the last 5-6 years. And before that, it probably wasn't much different. Recently, also, union deaths average about between one and two deaths per year, and that's just deaths. And when it comes to accidents, it's the same type of ratio. We are way safer than non-union. So if you're gonna have a mixed job, open shop, now you're gonna put us in harm's way. We have all our training, all our experience. And then you're going to put us in a place where we could get electrocuted because of somebody's ineptitude or lack of training. Somebody could drop something on your head. It is really dangerous. And when you see somebody carried out in an ambulance or worse, you know, it really hits home. And I've seen that. So that's the biggest reason for us to say union is better, and that's the most important thing, is that we go home at the end of the day.
Yeah, the stakes are high. It's not a game. It's life or death for people when you have these billionaires using these tactics to undermine unions. They're putting people's lives at risk for their own profits. They're putting their own selfish interest above anything else. And something else you mentioned was solidarity. Laura, would you be comfortable explaining the specific situation with the other buildings trades that are involved in Hudson Yards?
So from day one, Count Me In was a solidarity movement. The idea was that in order to beat Related, in order to beat Steve Ross, and in order to beat union busting, our greatest strength would be sticking together in solidarity with each other. So meaning that that nobody goes on the job unless we all go on the job. Because it, you know, it's easier for them to pick us off, to hire some union, some non-union. But we know, you know, we know for a fact they can't build it without us. They can't build it, you know, without all of us. So, so from day one, it's centered on solidarity and it's hinged on solidarity. There have been challenges to this solidarity as this campaign has gone on. It's included all along. It's included rank and file from every single building trade. I think this shouldn't be understated because it's pretty incredible and pretty unprecedented in recent years. There's over 100,000 union building trades workers that work in New York City. There's a large variety of trades. It's you know, we're all broken up into different unions. We have different leaderships. So the idea that the rank and file was sticking together despite these sort of built-in divisions, I think is a real accomplishment. Unfortunately, Related at some point did seek to peel off certain trades and to divide us, outside of the will of the rank and file, went directly to some of our internationals to attempt to make deals separately from the rest of the unions. And they did go to both my union, the carpenters, and to the Iron Workers International to try to make separate deals with us.
We keep coming back to this word rank and file, and I think it's really critical for understanding the best way for a union to operate when it's organized around the workers itself. And sometimes there are differences, as you just articulated, between the leadership and the workers. So what is the first just explain, like, what does rank and file mean in real life, and what is the difference between rank and file unionism and a business unionism?
So my understanding of rank and file is that we all work as carpenters and under a carpenter's contract. So I'm an elected leader to my local. Levi is an elected leader, the president. But we're both still rank and file because we work out in the field as carpenters. We don't. It's not a full time job for us. Being in an office. So that's, you know, first, that's kind of a baseline. My baseline definition of rank and file. That essentially means that there's material conditions that bring us together and that affect us and that mean that we have a shared fight. So we have a shared fight to be improving conditions on our jobs. We have a shared fight to maintain and improve our wages and benefits. So that's kind of some of the basis of it. And rank and file across the different trades, I think, have this. While we work under different contracts, we have this shared fight around conditions on the job, around safety, and around maintaining a decent standard of living. I would contrast this to business unionism, and I think I think to me, business unionism is kind of epitomized by this idea that we have to be partners with the contractors, or that we have to constantly try to win over the contractors by bending our rules, by working less safely, by being ever more efficient. To me, that kind of epitomizes business unionism. This idea that we're supposed to be partners with the contractors and with the developers, and One of the most promising things to me about Count Me In, besides the fact that it was an all trade solidarity movement, was the fact that it broke with this with kind of this business unionism model. It specifically said no, that you know, that Related is literally out there trying to union bust, trying to break us up, and that we were going to wage an open fight against that we're going to wage an open fight against Related, and that we're not trying to be partners with you, and we're not trying to bend our work rules for you and go some union, some non-union, that this is a line in the sand, and that this is an open fight that we're having with you. So,
like, in the sense that business unionism may offer a specific union some short-term gains, they can get a contract or a job, but in the end of the day, in the long term, it will undermine the actual power of that union. It will undermine the collective solidarity of all the different unions, and will create an environment that is dangerous for the workers in the workplace, that disempowers them, that gives more power to the bosses and to the owners, to capital. And it enables a divide and conquer strategy that in the long run, which we've seen in this country for the past 40, 50 years, leads to the near destruction of the union movement. I mean, here in New York City, we're a bit of an exception. There's still a strong union movement, but in the private sector, I think in the country, in the 70s, union density was around 35% for workers, and now it's declined to 6%, because there's been an attack by billionaires on unions, and at the same time, some unions have adapted a kind of survival strategy that, in the end of the day, has undermined their power to actually empower workers in the workplace. If you guys disagree with that, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. And like I said at our meeting to our members, there is a connection between politics and unionism that can't be ignored. For the last 40 years, and I agree that it's 40 years because I've seen it, and for the last 40 years, it's been on the decline. And to Laura's credit, she said that there's, you know, she sees some hope, and we're confident in now some changes happening. And what I see is progressive movement on the horizon that could start to change things in our direction. So I say let's pay attention to what's going on, not only in our union, but in our city, in our state, in our country, in our community.
Yeah, that's right. It's so critical for individual unions to show solidarity with other unions and just workers in general that aren't unionized, because the more people that are unionized, the more workers will be empowered. And so that's why I absolutely agree. It's really encouraging seeing this emergence of this progressive movement in politics. And then also this in the past year, there's been an increase in worker actions, especially in schools, but it's the hotel workers went out on strike. I can't think of all the strikes off the top of my head, but this past year, more workers went on strike than any time since 1986. So hopefully we're on the precipice of the tide turning. But to bring it back to this specific struggle at Hudson Yards, what was the action that was supposed to take place this Friday, and why is it no longer happening?
This Friday is the 15th is the official grand opening for Hudson Yards, for the first phase of it, mostly some shops and public spaces. And there was a call among the rank and file for an action to show up all day and to be out there and to in some ways to disrupt the grand opening. It was in some quarters it was being called a sick out because members were encouraging each other to take the entire day to go down to Hudson Yards. and it was there was organizing going on to try to make it as big as possible. So not just not just workers who are currently working at the Hudson Yards, but to make it a citywide action with construction workers all over the city, not showing up to work that day and going over to the Hudson Yards for this grand opening. So
what now that the action is not taking place, but that doesn't erase all of the incredible organizing that's been going on for these past few years and the Count Me In movement. So what does this mean for the rank and file organizing going forward and the strategy to continue to build this solidarity across unions?
Well, I think we can look at it as a win, because some of the trades that weren't at the table are now at the table. And that was the whole point of what they were doing. The people who put Count Me In together, their goal was to have 100% union on that job. And now it's possible that they might get that deal. So that's why they called off the action on 315. And if they don't get that deal, that action will be back on. I can guarantee it.
That's great to hear. So labor organizing, we've been talking about it a lot. But I think most people do not have it in their lives. So they don't even understand what it really means to organize your workplace and the type of work that goes into that and how critical it is to build trust and solidarity with your fellow workers. So what does organizing actually encompass?
So organizing encompasses, I think of the main kind of unit of organizing as being the one-on-one conversation. It's more than just the one-on-one conversation, but it relies on a one-on-one conversation and worker-to-worker organizing. The last time that there was a big, as far as I can tell, and I was not around at this point, but the last time that there was a large-scale sick out called citywide for carpenters, and the time that, you know, in my union, everybody talks about this, it comes up all the time. Everybody talks about this very glowingly as a time that we really won, was in 1999, a rally called the Roy K. Rally. And apparently what I understand is that it started with a call to a sick out. And there was a lot of really excellent organizing going on around this leading up to it. It was in the days before Facebook. So this organizing was not going on online. I've heard some members talk about this and talk about what happened, and one of the things that they emphasized was that they talked to everybody. They went and talked to every single worker in every single workplace, and they got workers involved in talking to each other, and decided, from what I understand, to have a sick out this day with a big rally. And 40,000 people showed up on Madison Avenue and took over part of the city, and were able to actually win. So I think I think the online organizing has its place. It's certainly helped. It's both helped us and hurt us, I would say, sometimes in the building trades. It's helped bring us together in terms of all the different trades. But I think it can be, sometimes it can be over relied on. And if you're not also doing the one-on-one conversations and the on-the-ground organizing in your workplace along with it, it's not enough by itself. So that's what I would say. And maybe Levi might be able to speak a little bit more to what happened in 1999.
Hear more about it. First of all, I just want to open up the phone lines, for our audience. We have around 10 minutes left. So please give us a call at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. But sorry for cutting you off, because I really want to hear more about this Roy K. rally and why collective organizing and action is so effective.
Well, I'd like to say something about that, because I was at the Roy K. rally, and I was kind of new in the union at the time. Every crew that I knew, we decided together that we were going to leave work. We went to work in the morning. We left about 10 o'clock in the morning, and we abandoned every job that I knew of. And it's impressive to see 40,000 people in the street, multiple trades, and that is the key to it. It's every single trade in the Building and Construction Trades Council was there. And the best thing about it is that it worked. In about a year's time, that job was union. They had a couple of hundred workers that were working for Roy K. It was just, you know, breaking ground. It wasn't, the job wasn't really off the ground yet, but it was going. It was going non-union. And before it really took off, that job was organized, and every trade in the building trades was in there, and it worked.
So it was a clear demonstration of how, when all these unions come together and, you know, people within the unions have these conversations and build these relationships and this trust, and they recognize that their interest is aligned, that you can really transform like the relations in the city, that you can give power to the workers rather than have these workplaces that you explained before that are non-union, that are dangerous, that have lower wages, and that really threaten the, like, the basic structure of our city, that in the long term it hurts all of us except for the richest people.
Exactly. And it's a testament to the bottom up grassroots type of unionism that we prefer as rank and file members to the modern top down or business unionism that we talk about. That's what it was. It was bottom up. Nobody gave us that. We took that.
And when it's grassroots, because sometimes, like, I feel like especially in New York, a lot of the tops of the so-called business unions, they have tight relationships with a lot of politicians. And a lot of these politicians are really deeply entwined with real estate developers because they're giving donations to their campaigns. So when you have a top-down controlled union, it makes these compromises because it already has these relationships. When you have a grassroots union, the relationships that exist, the power that's built, is on the ground. So the bosses are then forced to respond to this real power rather than going in already compromised.
Exactly. I agree. And all the money in the world isn't going to beat all the people in the city. And that's what you need. It's the numbers. We have the numbers. We always talk about the fact that we have the numbers. But if we're not using them, if we're not putting people in the street, then we're not using our numbers. That's our only weapon. So we have to use it. And when we do use it, we win.
Yeah, since the workers are without the workers, the city does not function. That there would be all the wealth and the profits of the bosses, of the ruling class, cannot be made without the workers. So the one thing is about fighting against this sort of divide and conquer strategy where the bosses want to pit the workers against each other, and overcoming this and saying, no, this is ridiculous. This is against our interest. If we recognize that the real power lies with us coming together, then anything is really possible. Things can change dramatically, and people can build something that's a real alternative to the sort of 40 years of austerity and union busting and just complete and massive wealth and income inequality.
Yeah, and I would like to say something along those lines to the people who aren't union-oriented, who don't belong to a union, that brotherhood and solidarity are real things. If you go on a construction site, a union construction site, it's always brother this, sister that. We're a family, and it's real. You can have that in your workplace, too. If you care about the people that you work with, and you care about yourself, and you realize that you, if you get together, you can change things, even in a small way, in your workplace. You can get things done. You can fix things. I don't care how small it is. It's worth doing, and it gives that sense of brotherhood to the workforce, and you should look for that, even if you're not in a union.
It's, I mean, and in a way, you know, we live in this society. People are so isolated from each other, and I feel like unions, because people spend so much time at work, and if you feel like you're always competing against your coworkers rather than you're in this together and you're working for the same goal, it really makes people feel so isolated, and it's probably a huge reason why there's so much anxiety and depression. It's not the only reason. But when you have a workplace where people can come together and fight for the same goals and realize you're in it together, then you, it changes your whole mindset and your worldview. And it really enables you to build power in a way that most people can't even imagine at this point when there's been such an attack on collective organizing.
Yeah, that might be true. I don't know what the numbers are, but I'll tell you, in our workplace, we're not depressed and we don't feel bad. We actually have people around us. We care about each other. We really do. It's for real. And sometimes I work in an occupied space and I see how people work in their cubicles and secluded in the, you know, they're not interacting with each other. You should come to our workplace. All we do is have a great time and build cities.
I'd love to come check it out. Before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask, what's going on? Is there anything coming up that people can get involved in? How do people reach out to Count Me In? And there's also a potential nurses' strike coming up. So, Laura, if you want to share any of this information, it'd be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, so as your show has covered before, there is a there's the potential for a nurses' strike coming up. It's not a definite thing yet. I believe at this point three hospitals have voted to authorize a potential strike. The nurses have been fighting for safe staffing. Hospitals around the city, and if you've ever had to go to one, that they're extremely understaffed. It's not right for the nurses. It means really horrible working conditions. It means a very high stress job. And it's not right for New Yorkers. It's not right for the patients. It means being put in a hallway. The nurses are fighting for all of us right now. And it's if they do go out, it's something that should be fully supported by every New Yorker. And that us in the building trades, especially being in a line of work where there is a higher risk of injury, we do end up at the hospital semi-regularly. It's something that's extremely important to us also. And I think, is something that we should all be out supporting. DSA's labor branch will be having a kickoff event for the nurses' strike, if there is a nurses' strike. I'm going to have to ask people to look for that on NYCDSA's calendar and on our Facebook page for the date. There's obviously a lot still kind of up in the air right now, but if a nurses' strike does happen, we will be having a kickoff event for that. Let's see what else.
How do people connect with Count Me In?
Oh yeah, sorry. Count Me In. We're currently, as was mentioned before, we're currently, you know, we're we've stepped back from doing an action on Friday since Related has come back to the table and is now appears to be negotiating in good faith with all the trades. However, if you want to follow what is happening with Count Me In, please visit the Count Me In Facebook page. If Related does not negotiate with all the trades, we may be back in the streets again. And you can find out through the Facebook page what's going on or what the next action will be.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you both for coming on the show and for all the organizing you're doing and helping to build worker power here in New York City. This is Revolutions Per Minute. You can find us on Twitter at RPM NYC. Or I might have reversed that. But just look up Revolutions Per Minute on Google and you'll find us. We're NYC DSA's WBAI show. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you guys next week.